Today being Yom HaShoah, I want to just take one moment of introduction to acknowledge personal family and that connection that we have for today. Several years ago, we had the unbelievable gift from God to be able to take all of our children to meet my grandmother and spend some time with her for a couple of days. At that time, as she was for the last almost 40 years of her life, she was living in Israel, and we traveled with our five children, and we get to spend 5 days visiting her each day. And it was very important and meaningful for me in particular to see that my children would have the opportunity to meet my grandmother. Because my grandmother wasn't just a babi, which is what we called her. She was a link to another world. Now, even though when I was younger, I didn't know that because she spoke with a New York accent and she seemed perfectly like everybody else, American, which she was really American. And she sang American nursery rhymes and songs with us as kids. Did you ever see a fishy on a bright and sunny day? See a little fishy? Like traditional.
I never learned that.
Okay, I could teach it to you later. But when I got older, she told me more about her story, and she came from a Polish family. Her father, his name was Chaim Zev Halevi Wolf Krantz. The Krantz-Levy Association, that family, are direct descendants of a very famous rabbinic luminary, a magid, a preacher, known as the Dubno Magid, the Magid of Dubno, who in the tail end of the 18th century was one of the most prominent preachers in all of Eastern Europe. So the Dubno Magid is a great ancestor of mine. So my grandmother, she came from this Polish family, but she grew up in Leipzig, Germany. And she told me that one day she remembers Nazi youth marching outside her window, and their family had a family meeting. Her mother was one of five sisters, and they had some kind of business there, and they decided they were all going to leave. And she went from there with her family to Holland, to a place called Scheveningen. And then there, she said it was wonderful. She was a little girl. She went to school. She didn't really feel anything was problematic. She was a refugee, but she had a fine experience. And then she came to America, where she settled down and married my grandfather after a period of time, etc. What I only found out later was that her father, Wolf, Chaim Zev Halevi, was one of eight children. And they were from a shtetl. I'll give you the name. The name of this shtetl it was called Pilsno. A Polish shtetl called Pilsno. Her grandfather, his name was Moshe Aaron. His father was named Avraham Leib. He was born in Pilsno in 1869, and he married a woman by the name of Gittel Haber in 1889. They stole things, yard goods, at the market in Pilsno. And he was the founder of the Talmud Torah there in this shtetl. In July of 1942, the Germans arrived in Pilsno to take care of what they were going to take care of. So most of the people in Pilsno were taken to a nearby town called Debica, and then they were taken to Belzec. But my grandmother's grandparents, who were still in this town, according to a cousin of my grandmother, who was an eyewitness, said that they were taken, Moshe Aaron and Gittel were taken to the mikveh with 20 other Jews on Tisha B'Av 1942, and that's where they were shot and killed. And the other children, they had eight children. My grandmother's father had seven siblings. One of them survived a woman who went to Uruguay, and the other six were killed. So the fact that our children had the zuchus, the benefit, the merit to meet my grandmother, who was the link in that chain. Her name was Pesel Bas Chaim Zev Halevi, Zichrona Levracha. Her name was Paula. Was a really important memory to create for our children. And I wasn't even aware of this story with her grandparents until last year when my father shared it with me. So I think about her today and her link to that world that no longer exists. So we're going to continue today for a few minutes to think about another piece of Holocaust literature. And the book that we're focused on today is Man's Search for Meaning, which is probably well known to everyone in this room, authored by a man who was, for that time, a number. His number was 119104, 119,104. But his real name was Viktor Frankl. This, of course, this Austrian Jew who lost his parents and his wife and his family. But he maintained his identity. And after the war, he wrote his reflections. And then this became embellished with more of his logotherapy work. This book, Man's Search for Meaning, originally he planned to publish it anonymously, but then his friends prevailed on him that he should put his name. And obviously, I'm not qualified to really analyze this work. This work is like, I mean, this is the subject of probably many, many PhDs and many great analyses. But I wanted to share a few key observations that I think we can take away from this work that probably everyone here has read and studied, but is something to think about when we think about spiritual resistance. And the first is that this book was published many, many dozens of times in many languages. So in the 1984 edition, so he died in 1997, Frankl, he was born in 1905, he writes about whether or not this, you know, he was asked, is this a success? Do you consider this a big success for you that your book was published a few million times in English and then hundreds of thousands of times in other languages? He says, well, I don't know what to tell you about a success. These are my paraphrasing. But he says, the fact that people are buying it, he says, quote, it must be a question that burns under their fingernails. And what's the question? The search for meaning. The fact that people are buying the book, he says, it doesn't say much about me. He says, it says about the door, the generation, that people are searching for meaning. And that's really what spiritual resistance is about. That's what this whole exploration is about, is how to find meaning. Where are we going to find meaning? And that's part of what he introduces to people. And although after the war he married a woman who was a Catholic, a practicing, religiously observant Catholic, what's interesting is that he continued to observe much of his own internal Jewish identity, in the sense that his family reported that he continued to maintain a daily davening practice, including tefillin, which only became known to the public when he was hospitalized at the end of his life, that his non-Jewish son-in-law said that it became known that he brought the tefillin with him. He had a very interesting, there's an article written by the head of the Chabad community in Vienna, which is where he practiced and lived, that the Chabad Shaliach there, it's a whole long story, whole long maisa about how there was his name is Yaakov Biederman. Biederman is a name that's connected to Reb Melech Biederman in Israel, the Lelev Chassidim. So this Chabad Chassid, this Chabad Shaliach in Vienna, describes that he spoke to Viktor Frankl toward the end of his life, and that Viktor Frankl felt a tremendous debt of Hakaras HaTov to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because somehow the Lubavitcher Rebbe knew that he was in Vienna, and that there was a woman, a survivor, who ended up in Crown Heights, had a meeting with the Rebbe, said that she's from Vienna, so he asked her when she goes to Vienna if she could go look up this guy, Viktor Frankl, and tell him that he's going to be a success, and that he should keep at it, and he's doing wonderful work. So this woman goes back to Vienna, tries to find Viktor Frankl, can't get in at the clinic, so she tracks him down at his house, knocks on the door, and tells him that the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Brooklyn tells you that you should keep going, and you should have what we call in Yiddish, we call it chizuk, strength, and you're going to be just fine. And he later related to this Chabad emissary that the Rebbe must have known something, because he was going through a very deep, dark period in his life, where he was in the process of despair, that his work was ever going to amount to anything, and that he thought maybe he was destined to just give it all up, and he was preparing to leave Vienna and just give it all up. And he said that the Rebbe sent him a message at that time, and that gave him the self-confidence to persevere. And then, of course, you know, by the end, his work has influenced countless people. So he himself, interestingly, from a spiritual and even from a religious practice standpoint, maintained that commitment till the end of his life, davening every day. His son-in-law reported that Viktor Frankl was once very irritated with him because, I don't know whether he knocked or he didn't knock, every day he had this solitude time, which was his davening, and this son-in-law of his once, I don't know if it was intentional, unintentional, opened the door when he was davening with his tefillin. And he was very upset that someone imposed on his personal time, of his ruchnius, of his spiritual experience. So I think that is the first thing, that A, he wants us to know that we're living at a time that people are searching for meaning. And that I think even just looking as an outsider at someone who had gone through all of that trauma and all of that experience, and yet he himself maintained that connection to that inner meaning, that spiritual and religious practice, which I thought was fascinating. That's number one. Number two is that he points out that the two different parts of the book are distinct. They're not disjunct, they're related to each other, but they're distinct. The second part is the theoretical construct of logotherapy. Logo is about meaning, and therapy is about how to help people create, you know, build their lives, put themselves back together through the search for meaning, meaning forward-looking as opposed to, you know, more psychoanalysis, which is reflective in the past. But he says the first part is different. The first part is related to his logotherapy, but it's not theoretical. He intersperses in the first section psychological reflections on what he was experiencing and thinking at the time. So it's a different type of teaching. He says that these first teachings are, in his words, at least in the translation. Remember, the first time it was written after the war, it was written in German, but then he translated it. It's not what he calls, on the 24th page, it's not detached. It's not detached. And that is a different kind of learning. The first kind of learning, which is the second part of the book, is theoretical. The second part is his own experience. It's an autobiographical experience. And he says, so from some perspectives, you could say that this type of psychological research or insight is biased. So he says he tried to be as unbiased as he could, but it is not detached. And I would say that it's very important to understand both halves of this book as typologies for learning. And these typologies of learning are things that break down in different aspects of our life, and they break down in different aspects of the museum. And in our context here, we fall on one side of this dichotomy. These two aspects are reflected in two Hebrew words. One is called chachma, and the other one is called da'as. What is the difference between the meaning of the word chachma and da'as in Hebrew? Anybody venture a Hebraic distinction? Yes.
What is it, futuristic?
Maybe. One might be futuristic. Maybe. We'll see how that develops.
And the other is an established.
Okay. Something established. So which is more established? It's a good question. But how would you, not to put anybody on the spot, but how would you distinguish between the words chachma, which probably in English, what's that?
Wisdom.
Right. Wisdom. And da'as, or da'at. What is da'at?
Knowledge.
Exactly. It's the difference between wisdom, or what we could call information, and da'as. Da'as is knowledge. What's the difference between information and knowledge?
Knowing and understanding.
Okay.
Knowledge is more intuitive.
Intuitive, What else?
Acquired,
meaning you possess one differently than you do the other. You could say that you create your identity. You absorb something. It becomes your knowledge. You identify with it. Becomes who you are. There's a connection. There's an inner feeling that is associated with knowledge. Das, knowledge, when you want to know what it really means, is you're going to look in the Chumash. Right? That's where you're going to find the information. And there's a great Hasidic master, Reb Tzadok HaKohen Rabinowitz of Lublin, end of the 19th century. He says, you want to know the heart of something, you always, the essence of it, you always want to look at the first time it appears in Chumash, in the Torah. So the first time the word das appears as a verb, it appears in the context of physical intimacy between a husband and a wife. That Adam and Eve had an intimate relationship with each other, which is referred to as das, vayeda Adam.
He knew her.
Yes, exactly. It means that they created this deep, intimate bond that unified them. When you have something that is knowledge, that's das, it's part of you. Chachma is koach, which means power, ma. The letters koach ma. It's koach ma. It doesn't have influence over you. It is a statistic. It's a piece of information. It's a fact. But you didn't necessarily absorb it. It didn't become part of your identity. This is the difference between information, between chachma and das, knowledge. You can go through. It could become das, yeah. So I'll give you an example just to that point. But before we do that, you can go through an experience, let's say a museum, and you could convey many facts, many pieces of information. And you could have visitors, students, guests who will walk out and they have a lot of information. But is that the goal? Are you looking for the visitors to the museum to walk away with information? Or are you asking them to walk away with knowledge, with something that becomes part of them, that it transforms their identity? This is why Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the first chief rabbi of the modern settlement of Israel, Rav Kook says, this is why Adam faltered when he ate from the original tree. What was the problem? That eats, that tree, how is it described as the eats what? Hadat what? Eitz hadat what? Hadat. It was an eitz hadat, a tree of knowledge of what? Knowledge of tov vera. So the tree somehow was a mixture. It was a blend of tov, good, and ra, bad. When you have something which is a blend, a mixture of Tov and Ra, how should you relate to that? Is that the same way that you're going to relate to something which is exclusively Tov, pure good? If something is pure good, what do you want to do with it? You want to absorb it. You want to imbibe it. You want to embrace it. But if something is complex, it has elements of Tov and elements of Ra, how do you relate to that? Do you want to just absorb it? Do you want to swallow it wholesale? No.
You want to hear opposition.
Exactly. You want to treat it like chachma, like information. You want to analyze it. You want to tease out what's positive, what's negative. You want to treat it with a scientific eye. Rav Kook says, what was the problem with eating from the tree? It was that he ate from the eitz that was das, tov, and ra. He absorbed a negative influence. There was nothing wrong with the tree. But when you have something that has a negative element to it, you need to analyze it. You need to have different sides of it. It's more complex. You don't just scarf it down. You don't just eat it. You don't absorb it. Because when you do that, you don't just absorb the tov. You also absorb the ra. All of this is to say that yediyah, das, knowledge, is absorbing. And so when you encounter the two parts of this book, you are really encountering Chachma, which is part two, the theoretical of the logotherapy, but the more powerful, the more transformational. And I guarantee you, the reason that people buy this book is primarily for the das, the first part. And that das is what he means when he says these are not dry theories. They are not detached because they have that level of das. But what I would suggest to you, and you probably know this intuitively, is that that same way that you develop an intimate relationship and you express that through the idea of das, it's the das part of the knowledge, that experience which creates connections. What transforms the people that you teach, or the transformational learning that you've done, I would suspect, is not in the realm of chachma. Your life is not transformed because you know how many people were lo aleinu sent to a particular camp at a particular date. But it's transformed by what that story means to you and how you internalize it and how you live by it, which now you see why I'm not so knowledgeable when it comes to the information. You know, I forget most things, certainly facts. So, you know, if you ask me in the hallway, can you remember, you know, what date or what person or what country, I won't necessarily be able to pull all the information off the top of my fingers, but I feel a deep connection to it. I've absorbed so many of these stories that I feel like that's part of my identity. And so even though I can't give you the exact fact off the top of my head, I do feel that, and that's why how much of our learning has been over the last umpteen years, how much of it has been about facts and figures versus how much is it about people, about experiences, about stories, because all of these live in the realm of da'as. And the ultimate goal of every human being is, Maimonides teaches, leida, to have knowledge of God, meaning that your life should be elevated with that fullness of spirituality. That's the mitzvah of Yediyas Hashem, the Rambam says. That's what you're getting for. It's not to have facts and figures. It's to be that kind of person. And so what this book does is it helps us parse, whenever we encounter something, is this information? And I'm just going to treat it like math. I don't know, maybe some of you, if you have a background in accounting, you love math. I don't identify with numbers at all. It's in the realm of chachma, it's information. So it's good, you have to know the information. You can't live detached from the facts. But the question is that the emphasis? Is that what's going to transform your experience? Or is it going to be transformed by das, by that knowledge, by that transformational quality, the non-detachment? And that's what's, I think, emerging in the distinction between the first and the second piece of the book. Yeah.
I would argue in the Hebrew language, there's no word for history.
Yes.
History is a time of facts, but like if you go to the Chumash, it's Zecher.
Beautiful. It's so memory. Exactly. Mickey's pointing out, not only is there no word in Chumash with the meaning historia, that's a modern Hebrew word, it's not really a word. You'll notice in rabbinic literature, for most of Jewish history, rabbis were not interested in writing history at all. In fact, much of the Talmud it's almost ahistorical. It's not given a historical context, specifically because it's not meant to be a book of chachma, it's meant to be a book of das. It's how do you lead your life? Where do you connect? How do you develop your own spirituality and your godliness? It's all in the realm of das. So that's why, for most of the time, and this is the you know, the Columbia Press professor, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, has a fantastic book, Zachor, where he pulls this out in different ways. But this is the distinction, I think, between part one of the book, which is really the das, the heart, the soul of the book, and the chachma, if you're interested in the technical aspects of logotherapy, that's going to be part two.
I mean, similar to Yaffa Eliyahu's, though, what she did in the Chassid of Tales, the Holocaust, it's not necessarily the facts that were true, but it was the ideas that they were evoking.
Exactly.
And the feelings that reading those stories would have for people.
Exactly, and that's why I saw there were some people who said, well, it sounds like from the book that he spent more time in Auschwitz than he did, and he was really only in Auschwitz for a little bit. But that's not the point. He was in Auschwitz, right? Obviously, for somebody to say, this is my yediya, and they weren't there, that's sheker, that's lie, that's falsehood. But to construct that story in such a way, he was there, he experienced this. This is not in the realm of chachma, this is in the realm of das, and that's exactly the power of those stories, right? Does it? Of course, if the person didn't have that happen to them, it's terribly misleading and it's a travesty. But does it really matter whether they were in Zhenushka or Chazushka? For the historians, it matters. And of course, but for the das side, it matters less. What matters is that it happened. Okay, that's... Watching the clock. That's point number two. Point number three, and this gets to the whole notion of how you define heroism, spiritual heroism. So he has a ha'ara, an observation, where he points out in the book on page 70 that people were, in their experience in the Holocaust, in the one that he's describing in a camp setting, whether it's a death camp or a concentration camp, for the most part, he says, they were so connected with, they were focused exclusively and totally on the immediate task of keeping oneself and one's closest friends alive, that anything else lost value. A man's character became involved to the point that he was caught in a mental turmoil which threatened all the values he held and threw them into doubt. Under the influence of a world which no longer recognized the value of human life and human dignity, which had robbed man of his will and had made him an object to be exterminated, skipping ahead, under this influence, the personal ego finally suffered a loss of values. If the man in the concentration camp did not struggle against this in a last effort to save his self-respect, he lost the feeling of being an individual, a being with a mind, with inner freedom and personal value. And so therefore, what happened when a person was able to stand up to this task and maintain even a shred of that value? That is the greatest heroism. So if you fast forward later in pages 86 and on, he has a whole discussion here about how he says, it sounds like from what I'm saying, from this psychological presentation and a psychopathological explanation of the typical characteristics of a concentration camp inmate, I may give the impression that the human being is completely and unavoidably influenced by his surroundings, meaning in this context, the camp life, the prison, the whole thing. But what about human liberty? What about spiritual freedom? And on, what about your reactions? We can answer these questions from experience as well as on principle. The experiences of camp life show that man does have a choice of action. There were enough examples, often of a heroic nature, which proved that apathy could be overcome, irritability suppressed. Man can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions of psychic and physical stress. We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. So when I saw this, I thought this is really a kiyum, a fulfillment. You would use the halachic term a kiyum, a fulfillment of what we just experienced in the holiday of Passover, of Pesach. That we were redeemed to cheirus olam, eternal freedom. What was eternal freedom? We were locked in a prison. We were dehumanized. We were constricted in Mitzrayim, which really means meitzarim. Meitzarim means straits. Barbed wire, but God freed us. He gave us the spiritual identity to be able to make that kind of choice to comfort someone else. And that's freedom. When I came back to this now in preparation after Yontif, after Pesach, I was like, oh, that's the pshat of Chayrus Olam, of freedom. That is the spiritual nobility which is granted to the Jewish people in particular, but by extension, every human being created B'Tzelem Elokim that has a soul, a divine spark created in the image of God. So the spiritual heroism was the ability to not be entrapped and ensnared by the limits of Meitzarim, of the Egyptian coercion, of the German oppression, and to be able to preserve a vestige of what he calls spiritual freedom. And that the choices that a person makes, he says they were making choices at every hour, and those are heroic choices. And now you can fill in, based on your own knowledge and the many countless stories that we've told over the years, how these stories express this idea that people made choices. Even if everything else was stripped away from them, they made choices. And that brings me to the fourth observation. I'm going to make five. The fourth observation. And that is that this idea, this whole notion of making a meaning-based choice, which is the essence of logotherapy, about finding and creating meaning, helps us understand an important text. This text is a controversial text. It is a biblical, canonical work, but it is fraught. It is so fraught that the sages of the Talmud describe that they considered concealing and banning this book. It's so complicated. It's so fraught. And what is that book? The book is called Koheles. Koheles is translated in English, as you have in front of you, as Ecclesiastes. I'm just going to mention that English word once because I can't really pronounce it well. We're going to go with Koheles. But Ecclesiastes, if you want the English version. What does the book of Koheles tell us? If you see, you have the English on the left side. Divrei Koheles ben David, this book is authored by Solomon, the wisest of all men. Divrei Koheles ben David, Melech Yerushalayim. Havel havolem omar Koheles, havel havolem hakol havel. Everything is futile. What are we bothering working? Ma Yisrael la'odem b'chol amolo, verse 3. What's the point? Dor holeich v'dor ba, verse number 4. V'zarach Hashem ashubo Hashem, as the sun rises, the sun sets. It goes around, everything comes back to the same point. Why bother? I'm trying to figure this out, says the greatest of all philosophers and scientists. Says, I can't crack this. It's so frustrating. It's exasperating. The futility of it. Go to Yud Beis, the second section. Ani Koheles, I Koheles, meaning Shlomo, King Solomon. Hayisi Melech HaYisrael B'Yerushalayim. I was the king. I was the king over everything. I had everything. V'nasati Aslibi, I pointed my attention. Lidros V'loser B'Chochma. To explore and to learn in wisdom. Al kol hashenasa tachas hashemesh. Everything that's given under the heavens. Hu inyan ra. It is a bad thing. Nasan elokim levnei adam lanos bo. God has given us, the word lanos is an interesting word. It doesn't mean to become involved or to be suffering. This is what God gave us, shkoyach. Ro'isias kol hamasim, I saw everything in 14. What happens? And you can't fix that which is broken. I thought to myself, I had so much knowledge. Go to 17. So then I start to pay attention to wisdom, but also to folly, to insanity. And then he says the clincher of this, the end line of this parak. Berov, ki berov chachma rov kas. More knowledge. Chachma, more knowledge. Rov kas, more anger. The Yosef das, if you have, so rov chachma, I should say, is more information. So the Yosef das, if you have more knowledge, Yosef machov, you have aggravation, cave. So what's the pshat in this book? Wow. This is like dreadful. And this goes on for chapters and chapters. What is King Solomon trying to tell us? So one of the great gifts in my life is my mother-in-law, she'll live and be well, who is a prodigious and prestigious scholar and educator. So she invited me to learn with her Bechavrusa as a study partner. So I was very excited about this idea. So we learn either on the Zoom or on the phone. So I said, what do you want to learn? She wants to learn Koheles. So when first she suggested, I was like, oh gosh, seriously? It's literally like the worst book of all of Tanakh. Like that's what we're stuck with?
I think she was, it had to do with her relationship with
you. It could be had something to do with that. I don't know if it was a subliminal messaging there. So she says she wants to learn Koheles. She never really understood Koheles. Like, fine, I don't understand most things, so it's good. So we started studying Koheles, and it was mamish mind-blowing. So there is an observation here, which we kind of glossed over, that I want to harp on, and that is that the word God is described here with a specific name. God can be referred to by many different names, that source of all source. It can be used, let's say with the, I think in English you call it the tetragrammaton, the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey, the four-letter name of God, which is probably the most common one. But that's not how it's referred to in the book of Koheles. It's referred to, God is referred to in source here in the verse 13 as Aleph Lamed Hey Yud Mem, which is pronounced with a hey, but we'll pronounce it Elohim, not to say the name of God for no reason. What is the difference between the four-letter name of God and the name Elohim? Well, the name Elohim is described when God created the world. Bereshis bara Elohim, when God created the world. The word El means power. If you refer to a pagan deity in the Chumash, you refer to it as Elohim Achirim, other sources of power that don't exist. There's no such power to any of these things, but you imagine they have power. Elohim is the name of Hashem that relates to the natural world. That's why it's the gematria of the nature in Hebrew. So my mother-in-law has a cousin who passed away who wrote a book on Koheles. His name is Heschleiman. So my mother-in-law has this book, so she found this point that Koheles uses the word Elohim. The realm of Koheles, the operating sphere, the theater of reality that he's operating is in the realm of Elohim, of Tachas HaShemesh, under the sun, the world of science. When a person engages in the pursuit of information, specifically scientific information about the material world, you can find many, many fascinating things. But as Rabbi Sachs points out, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in The Great Partnership, which is an excellent book, if you're thinking about the fact that science and religion have to have some kind of conversation, and he points out that they're not arguing at all, he said that when you pursue science, you answer many questions, but you open up new ones. And the new ones that you have are not the same kinds of questions. When you have a scientific pursuit, you are trying to figure out the size of something, the measure of something, the cause of something. These are all questions. You take something big and break it down into small pieces. But scientists cannot answer the question, what is the meaning of it? What do you do with it? Other than like put it in a laboratory. So Shlomo HaMelech is saying, look, I'm a brilliant man. I can philosophize. I can speak the language of the birds. That means I understand every aspect of nature, photosynthesis. I understand everything. But at the end of the day, the life of meaning is absent. It's so frustrating. I see struggling people. I see people who are struggling with poverty, with illness, with mental health challenges, with all kinds of struggles. Our 7-year-old son, Ami, he's afraid of thunderstorms. And he asked me 2 times this week, he asked me this question. He said, why did Hashem make lightning? He said, doesn't lightning hurt people? Why did Hashem make lightning? This is a hard question to answer to a 7-year-old. Why would Hashem make lightning if lightning hurts people? There are so many questions that scientists don't answer because it's not their tchum, it's not their realm. The realm of Koheles, the frustration of Koheles is at some point, all of these scientific and philosophical answers, they just lead me to frustration. But there's an alternative. There's an alternative to the book of Koheles that Shlomo HaMelech wrote. You know what that book is? That's the book of Shir HaShirim. The love song between the Jewish people and God. Where you're not operating on the level of nature. You're operating on a transcendent level. The name of God that is the Yud and He and Vav and He. That's the God of transcendence. Totally different experience. The only way to find meaning in the world of nature, of Elohim, is to take those letters and ask the question, Mi Eile? Elohim, Aleph, Lamed, He, Yud, Mem, the same letters as Mi Eile, who is behind all of this world? Who with a capital H? When the Jews came out of Egypt and they made an idol, what did they say about the golden calf? Eile Elohecha Yisrael. They forgot the me. They forgot who is behind the force of the natural world. Who's the mover of all the movement? So this is the difference. This is essentially what Frankl is trying to bring out. That you could live in a world of teva, of nature, and be suffering terribly, but still create meaning which belongs in the domain of Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. You can escape the suffering of Koheles and move into the world of Shir HaShirim. It's a totally different type of existence. You can choose to make that meaning.
There's a line in the book, I think it's Dostoevsky, who says, I should be worthy of the suffering I'm going through.
Meaning?
Meaning that yes, I have this terrible existence, but my internal being should benefit and growth and have meaning.
Exactly. I should create some kind of meaning. Exactly. Like he tells the little Maisa where this acquaintance of his was terribly, terribly broken and depressed because his wife of many years had passed away. And he said, this is not exactly great therapy, but he said to him, what would have happened if you would have died first? He said, well, she would be bereft and suffering. He said, well, in that case, maybe you can view her dying first as your sacrifice for her. It's a new way of looking at it. And he said that the guy, Taka, felt better because he was able to change his perspective and view it to create, this is what Dr. Pelkovitz, my Rebbe in psychology, talks about, creating meaning. So you have a new frame. This is the yesod of what he's trying to say. If I understand logotherapy correctly, which I probably don't, but to the extent that I can understand it, this is probably what he's trying to do. He's trying to help people go from Koheles, where they feel that they're trapped in this cage of Hevel Havolim, what's life worth living, right? He tells the story of a guy who they were walking in a field after the war, and there was some greenery growing there, so Viktor Frankl wanted to walk around, not to trot on the plants. And the other guy grabs him by the arm, and they walk through the field, and they trample on the greenery. And he says, after my wife and my whole family were gassed and everything is gone, what's the difference? That's the life of Koheles. Lo Aleinu, we should never know from such suffering. Because Taka, what did Thomas Hobbes say? Nasty, brutish, and short is the natural world. That's what he said. But you can choose something else. You can choose to create meaning. You can choose to move away from Koheles and realize that what Koheles is telling us is that you should not be absorbed in this world. You should, and that's, by the way, this is what my mother-in-law and I were discussing. If you go back to the distinction that we had before between Chachma and Das, what does it say? Berov Chachma, more Chachma, Rov Kas, you get angry. If you have more information, the more philosophical information you have, you get more angry. But Yosef Das, If you're looking for da'as, if you're looking for connection, if you're looking for a feeling of an identity in the physical world, Yosef Mach'ov, it hurts. It's painful. It's different than anger, right? Kas is anger. It's frustration that the more information you have, the more frustrated you are at the seeming, you know, valuelessness of life. But if you try to identify with it, if it becomes das, it mamish hurts. It's Yosef Machov. So he invites us to choose a spiritual path with meaning. Okay, and this brings us to the last point, which is the fifth ha'ara. So we talked about, number one, the burning under the fingernails, searching for meaning. Number two, the difference between chachma and das. Number three, heroism. And number four, the difference between Koheles and Shir HaShirim. But this brings us to the last, and I'll only mention it, I'll regalachas for those who were not there, but for those who we had the privilege to host at our home for our annual Shabbos Suda, our Friday night dinner, we talked about a similar type of dichotomy, which is really the next step of this. The difference between consumerism and covenantalism. This is what we talked about. That.
Excuse me, there's such a word as
covenantal? I just made it up.
Oh.
I don't know if there is such a word. It's covenantal, but I needed it to match consumerism, so we're just going to have to pretend like that exists. Right? It's the consumer versus the covenantal. The consumer is about what you can measure. It's what's my value proposition. I'm gonna get what I pay for it, and I'm not gonna get it until I know what I'm getting. Because you wouldn't buy a car without finding out what it costs. You wouldn't buy a car without finding out what the specs are. Does it have, you know, does it have a motor? Right? Does it have leather seating? Does it have power windows? Remember, I'm old. It didn't have such things. Not every car. Sometimes you didn't have the power windows in the car. So you wouldn't buy a car because it's a consumer product. But when it comes to a covenant, when it comes to a relationship, do you know everything about your spouse when you marry them, when you make a commitment to spend your whole life with them? You don't know everything.
Yeah, I never got married.
Right? That's exactly right. If you view marriage through a consumer perspective, you're never, we have to be careful what we say in public, right?
Be careful what you say.
Exactly. And the Hamas spies. What gets repeated. But it's true, right? What is the point of a marriage or a friendship or any type of relationship? It's a commitment for a lifetime of growth. Of people knowing each other, getting to know each other more. Not, oh, I knew everything about you. Adrava, that's why, really, your wedding date from a marital standpoint, that's the first day of everything. That's when you begin to get to know each other. That's why when Hashem appears to us and we say, Naaseh v'nishma, we'll do and then we'll listen, we're saying to God, we want a relationship. This is not a consumer product. The Torah is not It's not an iPhone that you're deciding whether you want the iPhone 12 or the iPhone 13. It's not a product. It's not a transaction. It's a relationship. And I think if we want to try to plot these ideas, we talked about the idea of chachma and koheles. You can extend that to the consumerism. It's about a thing. It's something you can measure. It's something that you're going to put a financial price tag on. Versus on the other side of the column, you have das, which is something which is knowledge, connection, which is related to Shir HaShirim, which is about a relationship. And that is the source of a covenant. And in life today, we talked about this that Friday night, really awesome insight for Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, the president of YU. In life today, we live in a society which is so consumer-driven. So consumer-driven. So it's about what is it that I'm going to get for my dollar and making sure that it's curated specifically for my interests. When you have a relationship with someone, not everything goes to what you want. You don't get to press on exactly the songs that you want at the time that you want them when it comes to a friendship. when it comes to any type of covenant, any type of relationship, that's about a commitment. It's going to go through all different kinds of periods of change. So when we think about spiritual resistance and what we're trying to educate people, is that we're going to make choices. Are we going to live in a world of commodities? And the ultimate sin of commodification is exactly what Viktor Frankl is describing, which is the commodification of, Rachmon al-Islan, God forbid, a human being, to reduce people to expendable commodities, lo aleinu. Or are we going to choose a different frame? That we're going to look at interactions not as transactions and a zero-sum game between, you know, interlocutors? Are we going to look at people as human beings? Exactly that. And that we have a covenant. We have a relationship with every single human being that exists. And that we're going to treat them and relate to them in a covenantal manner.
Potential growth.
Potential growth, openness, all of these types of frames and experiences. Not always what is it going to be in it for me. That's the nature of a spiritual life. That's really the nature of the context of meaning. So I think if we carry these forward, it actually has very practical applications to what kind of life we want to lead and what we're trying to teach our students, our children, and the next generation.